This.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The level of vaccination has dropped out because of the insecurity, the displaced population. And, of course, the disruption of vaccination during the COVID pandemic. So more children are at risk and are already dying. We are already in a health crisis.
That's the WHO Assistant Director General for Emergencies Response, who says acute food insecurity in the Horn of Africa also triggered a health crisis. Details coming up. Also, 1 week before voting, opinion polls in Kenya show Raila Odinga in front by 6 percentage points. We have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. President Joe Biden says a U.S. missile strike from an unmanned drone killed al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri, one of the world's most wanted terrorists, over the weekend. Biden said now justice has been delivered. Al-Zawahiri was believed to be a key architect of the September 11, 2001 attacks on the U.S., along with the 2000 USS Cole attack and the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. He took over the reins of al-Qaeda after Osama bin Laden was killed in 2011 and had a $25 million U.S. bounty on his head. Senior White House officials told reporters last night that the operation targeted a house in the Afghan capital Kabul with no U.S. personnel on the ground. Residents in Kabul reported hearing multiple blasts early Sunday, shortly after missiles struck the house. The Taliban strongly condemned the attack, but U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said they had violated an agreement with Washington to not allow Afghan territory to be used by terrorists to threaten the security of other countries. Recent United Nations assessments suggested that al-Qaeda, boosted by leadership stability and the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan a year ago, appeared to be positioning itself to once again be the world's preeminent terror group and the greatest long-term threat to the West. It has launched violent affiliate groups in the Middle East, West and East Africa, and South Asia. The World Health Organization warns many of the more than 80 million hungry people in the Horn of Africa also are facing a health crisis as hunger-related malnutrition and disease grows. WHO is launching an urgent appeal of $123.7 million to provide emergency aid until the end of the year. Lisa Schlein has the story from Geneva.
UN aid agencies report more than 80 million people in the Greater Horn of Africa are facing a level of hunger not seen in decades. They warn up to 20 million people, about half children, already are on the verge of starvation across Somalia, Ethiopia, and Kenya. WHO Assistant Director General for Emergencies Response, Ibrahima Sosefal, says this acute food insecurity crisis also has triggered a health crisis in the region. He says malnutrition is soaring and disease outbreaks, including measles and cholera, are increasing. Speaking on a line from Dakar, Senegal, Fall says the important role health plays in the response to famine crises often goes under-recognized. Consequently, he says, health care is less available just when people need it most.
It is very unfortunate that people's access to health care is more restricted because they are on the move in search of food, water, pressure, and they may also have to make hard choices like between buying food and going to see a doctor.
Fall says WHO's multi-million dollar appeal will be used to prop up the healthcare systems in 7 affected countries: Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan, Sudan, and Uganda. He says the focus of the appeal is to make sure severely malnourished children who are sick get the care they need.
The level of vaccination has dropped out because of the insecurity, the displaced population. And of course, the disruption of vaccination during the COVID pandemic. So more children are at risk and are already dying. We are already in a health crisis. It's not only a nutrition crisis. The number of children dying from diseases. So the situation is already catastrophic, and we need to act now.
Fall notes, the competition for dwindling resources has become more intense since war broke out in Ukraine in February. However, he says it is not conscionable for international donors to just fund the crisis in Ukraine and not act to prevent people from dying from hunger and disease in the Horn of Africa. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Three major UN agencies have announced a new alliance to eliminate the gap in treatment between children and adults with HIV/AIDS. The World Health Organization, UNICEF, and UNAIDS say they will work to improve treatment in infected infants and children, only about half of whom receive needed medicines, compared with 72% of adults who are receiving antiretrovirals. The three organizations say they will work with civil society movements and national governments, including the U.S. PEPFAR program, to close the gap by 2030. 12 African countries have joined the effort, including Angola, the DRC, Kenya, Nigeria, South Africa, Uganda, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The program will improve the detection, prevention, and treatment of pregnant and breastfeeding girls and women, children and infants living with HIV. It will also work to end social and structural barriers that prevent access to services. At an international AIDS conference this week in Montreal, the WHO's Director General, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, called the failure to fully treat children with HIV a scandal and a stain on our collective conscience. Nigeria will launch the new alliance in Africa at a ministerial meeting in October. 1 week before voting, an opinion poll in Kenya's presidential election shows former Prime Minister Raila Odinga in front by 6 percentage points over Deputy President William Ruto. Victoria Munga has the story from Nairobi, Kenya.
In the survey released Tuesday by Ipsos Group, 47% of respondents say they will vote for former Prime Minister Raila Odinga in next week's presidential election. Kenya's Deputy President William Ruto was second at 41%, with George Wajakoya and David Maure a distant third and fourth respectively. 9% of voters were undecided. Under Kenya's election system, a candidate needs to win 50% of votes plus one to be declared the winner and avoid a runoff. Samuel Muthoka is the East and Horn of Africa Director at Ipsos.
Should Raila convert half of the undecided voters, he will win this election first round. If Dr. William Ruto converts the 100% of the undeclared votes, he will force a rerun.
Another recent survey by Trends and Insights for Africa, TIFA, found that Odinga was the most preferred candidate at 46.7%, while Ruto polled at 44.4%. The Ipsos survey taken between July 23rd and 30th shows Odinga's sweet spot is his legacy as a Democrat and experienced leader, while those who support Ruto believe he presents hope with a clear plan for the country's future. Odinga's age and Ruto's integrity issues are their major drawbacks, according to the polls. Odinga is 77 years old, while Ruto is accused of multiple corruption issues. Muthoka says the election comes down to a few geographic areas, including major population centers in Mombasa, Nakuru, Kiambu, and Bungoma counties.
We see that Raila Odinga has 18 counties that already have a voter preference of above 55% for him. And William Ruto has 17 counties where voter preference is 55% for him. We think that could be a clear win for those candidates. However, we have about 11 counties which we present as a battleground.
At least 85% of more than 6,000 people sampled nationally said they were likely to vote in the August 9th election. 15% of voters said they are likely to stay away. Employment and corruption prevention were highlighted as main issues among urban residents in the survey, while rural voters said they were most concerned about employment and education. The election will be Kenya's third under a constitution established in 2010. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Senegal's ruling and opposition parties are both claiming victory as provisional vote tallies come in from Sunday's legislative election. Former Prime Minister Aminata Touré, who heads the ruling coalition, announced on national television that the party had won the majority of administrative departments. Meanwhile, the main opposition coalition said in a statement yesterday that it has defeated the ruling party in most departments. The final nationwide results of the election are not expected to be known until at least Friday. Senegal is considered one of the African continent's most stable democracies, but there is concern because President Macky Sall has not ruled out running for a third term in 2024, a move that would go against the country's constitution. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Last Friday, Egypt lodged a protest to the UN Security Council against Ethiopian plans to fill the reservoir of the controversial Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD, for a third year without agreement from downstream countries. The multi-billion dollar GERD is said to be the largest hydroelectric project in Africa, but has been at the center of a dispute with Egypt and Sudan ever since work began in 2011. Professor John Mukum Mbaku is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. He has written numerous articles regarding the dam. I first asked him to explain what this long-standing feud between the neighboring countries was all about.
In order to understand the conflict that you have between the two parties, one party is Ethiopia, and the other party consists of Egypt and Sudan. This conflict in modern times originates from the early 1920s. What happened is that since the 1920s, Egypt and Sudan, through treaties, colonial era treaties, have established near total control of the Nile. And so this is the outcome of the, or rather the source of the conflict that you have in the Nile.
We have a situation where the construction is almost complete, and we are now in that phase where the filling of the dam is now a big issue. Filling of the dam, will it be harmful for Egypt or Sudan?
Egypt and Sudan have argued that the filling of the dam would constitute significant harm to water flows into Egypt and Sudan. But the Ethiopians have argued that that would not be the case, and that even if they fill the dam in a shorter period than the period designated by Egypt and Sudan, the downstream countries will still not suffer. There were a lot of discussions over trying to for the three countries to achieve an agreement on the filling period and also on how to manage the dam. Some of the meetings were held with the help of the African Union, and some were held with the help of the World Bank and the U.S. government under Mr. Trump. But none of those agreements ended up being constructive in that, as we came to see, many of the discussions were bogged down by the fact that the Egyptians and the Sudanese wanted their acquired rights, the rights that they acquired through the 1929 and 1959 treaties. They wanted those rights to be the baseline for negotiations. And Ethiopians say if those rights were taken as the baseline for negotiations, then they would never agree to that, because they would essentially be saying they don't have any right to use the waters of the Nile for any reason. And so that's why they were never able to achieve any agreement. So Ethiopia proceeded to unilaterally fill the dam and started filling the dam in 2020, usually during the rainy season, And the first filling took place in 2020 and the second one in 2021. And as far as we can tell, those two fillings did not have any significant damage to water flows into Sudan and Egypt. So this summer, Ethiopia is supposed to begin its third filling. And authorities in Addis Ababa have already mentioned that they do not believe that that third filling would have any significant impact on water flows to Egypt and its Sudan.
What are like the benefits of this hydropower dam to the region, to Ethiopia, to the surrounding countries?
The dam is supposed to produce 6,000 kilowatts of megawatts of power, more power than Ethiopia really needs. When this dam is fully functional and produces electricity, Ethiopia would be able to send electricity to the rural areas, and that would increase economic development and industrialization in Ethiopia. For the other countries in the region, like Sudan, Ethiopia would be able to sell excess electricity to them at a very affordable rate, which would make it possible for countries like Sudan and South Sudan to be able to engage in rural electrification and have opportunities to provide for more economic development. So there are a lot of benefits for the region from this dam, not just for Ethiopia, but also for the region going as far as Somalia and even Egypt when this dam becomes fully functional. And one of the things that the Ethiopians have made clear is that once the dam is filled, it starts fully generating electricity. There will be no need for Ethiopia to interfere with the flow of water to the downstream countries, because this dam is not an irrigation project. It is a hydroelectric dam whose main function is to generate electricity.
That was Professor John Mukumumbaku. He talked to me from the U.S. state of Utah. The streets of Batibo district in western Cameroon were deserted today following 3 days of clashes between government forces and separatist fighters. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Civilians said an uneasy calm reigned in the Batibo district, located in Cameroon's English-speaking northwest region. Emmanuel Ma, a 27-year-old primary school teacher, said very few civilians could be seen walking the streets of Batibo on Tuesday morning.
People cannot go to their farms. Shops are sealed, markets are sealed, and traders are running away for their safety. Houses are burned down and the population suffers. So the fighting between the military and the separatists are causing much havoc to the population.
Mba spoke by the messaging app WhatsApp. He said several dozen Cameroon government troops have been searching homes in Batibo and arresting people suspected of collaborating with separatist fighters. The Cameroon military said Tuesday that 17 separatist fighters were killed in 3 days of fighting in Batibo. The military said an additional 18 fighters were captured in Bambui, Batibo, and Noni, all towns in the northwest region. The military also said it destroyed or seized weapons, locally made explosive devices, and several dozen motorcycles used by the separatists to attack government troops. Capo Daniel, deputy defense chief of the Amazonian Defense Forces, one of the separatist groups in Cameroon's western regions, said the group lost 11 fighters as well as weapons and motorcycles. He says the fighting was fierce in Enyo and Ewa villages located in Batibo district.
The Amazonian Defense Forces assembled over 300 forces to launch attack in Bamenda City. Our forces were attacked from multiple fronts. We suffered some losses. The major operation where our soldiers were supposed to carry out as they assembled will be scrapped as a result of the setback.
Daniel said separatists on Tuesday ordered their fighters who were deployed to attack Bamenda, the capital of the northwest region, to immediately retreat to their camps. He said separatist leaders will meet in the days ahead to strategize how to coordinate further attacks against Cameroon's military. Separatist groups say at least 24 government troops were killed in the Batibo confrontation. The military denied that any of its troops were killed, saying that a few sustained minor injuries. Cameroon government officials in the northwest region are calling for calm and asking civilians to collaborate with the military by reporting suspected fighters in their towns and villages. The military says it will protect all civilians and their goods. Armed groups have been fighting since 2017 to separate two English-speaking regions of Cameroon from the country and its French-speaking majority. The UN says the conflict has killed more than 3,000 people and displaced more than 500,000. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Tunisia has denounced what it called unacceptable statements by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and American Ambassador nominee Joey Hood. To explain this, Mohamed El-Shenawy talked to a senior fellow at Carnegie, Sarah Yerkes.
First of all, it shows that the United States actually does have an impact and that Kais Saied is paying attention to what the United States says. This statement is not actually that dramatic of a departure from the past statements or from the private messages that the U.S. administration, including Blinken himself, have delivered to Saied over the past year. And it doesn't really represent any sort of change in U.S. policy. So I think a lot of what we can read from Saied's reaction is actually more like theater, like grandstanding. And I think it's important that we note that the U.S.-Tunisia relationship is really largely based on shared democratic values. And so it's naive for Saied to think that the United States is going to continue its sort of business as usual after he's dismantled Tunisia's democracy. He probably hoped that once the referendum passed, the world would move on, but that clearly isn't the case. I think as long as he continues to operate as an autocrat, he should expect to be treated like one by the United States and Europe.
While the Tunisian government wanted to cover up for the shortcomings of a new constitution that lacks checks and balances and weakened rules of both the parliament and the judiciary, it was remarkable that the strong Tunisia Labor Union and 13 other civil society organizations denounced what they described as a flagrant U.S. intervention in Tunisia's internal affairs. How do you explain that?
I think it's really not that surprising that these civil society groups in particular made such a statement. Many civil society groups, including the labor union, have long been critical of what they see as attempts by outside groups to interfere in Tunisian affairs. And, you know, they have every right to be critical of the United States and European actions. But I think we have to remember that the labor union, as well as some of the other prominent CSOs, never condemned Saied's actions. They were not the groups that were sort of on the forefront pushing against the referendum. And so we shouldn't actually be that surprised that they're sort of cozying up to Saied now by parroting his language. On the other hand, there are a lot of other brave civil society organizations that have condemned Saied's action and have taken to the streets over and over again to protest him, to protest the referendum in particular, some of whom have actually faced police brutality for their actions. These are not the groups that are condemning continued U.S. support for democracy. Rather, they are actually calling for additional U.S. and European diplomatic, rhetorical, and financial support for democracy.
Experts and lawmakers say that the Biden administration's approach to President Kais Saied's actions has been largely reactive, and a more strategic plan of action is needed to save Tunisian transition to democracy. Can you elaborate on what the U.S. should do or could do in coordination with the European Union?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there has been a largely reactive approach over the past year. You know, there have been several opportunities, particularly in that sort of first 30-day window after Kais Saied's coup, when he initially had a 30-day temporary measure in place. During that time, the United States and Europe could have, and frankly should have, taken a much stronger stance and potentially could have stopped Saied in his tracks. They didn't do that. They were sort of a little more wishy-washy then. And so the U.S. and European approach has largely not been successful. Saied's kind of marched forward regardless of any sort of pressure from the U.S. and Europe. Back on Tunisia out of fear for their own domestic interests primarily.
Sarah Yerkes from the Carnegie Middle East Program and talking to VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.